Good morning. It's a pleasure actually to be here. It was a couple of years ago in a similar actually conference that focused on global optimization. This time I'm going to focus on work that is from the group of my students, Pete DiMaggio, Ashwin Subramanian, and Scott McAllister, and that focuses on bi-clustering methods. And the highlight is that we are looking for exact methods based on integer linear optimization, as well as their applications and comparative studies with a variety of other types of algorithms. So as an outline of the talk, we are going to focus on clustering based on reordering. So the fundamental idea is reordering rows and columns. And we're going to attack two classes of clustering, dense data as well as sparse data. And we will see applications for both types of data. And then, if time permits, we are going to consider in vivo prediction of toxicity out of in vitro experimental data in a variety, actually, of experimental vendors. So we had actually two talks this morning that provided a very good introduction to the subjects of clustering and the use of optimization. So the fundamental point, we want to elucidate patterns in large-scale data. They should be, all these data have noise level, and there are actually a number of applications. Since the conference focuses on biomedicine, we are going to restrict ourselves into that. And some of the traditional clustering methods belong into the hierarchical category, partitioning, and typically they are used using heuristics, especially if the data size actually increases. As a result, the solutions from the mathematical viewpoint are suboptimal. So we're going to really look into that, and again, the concept is rearrangement of rows and columns, reordering. Yes, it has a large number of possible orderings, but also at the same time, there is a very interesting paper that goes back in the early 70s that demonstrated that it can be casted as a traveling salesman problem. So one of the methods that we're going to advocate is to use actually Concord and the traveling salesman problem formulation so as to do the optimal reordering of large data sets. So we're going to, in fact, discuss two types of models for bi-clustering, one based on network flow and the other based on the TSP. Both are exact, given the corresponding objective functions. And then we're going to present computational studies on synthetic bi-clusters, metabolic concentration data, colon cancer data, yeast segregant data, and even other systems, like on applications in protein folding, applications also in image recognition. So bi-clustering and clustering have really ubiquitous applications. So as an overall review, and I think Panos provided some of the early work actually by Cheng and Church, who saw that it's an NP-hard and provided really a heuristic method. And many of the methods, even though they are published in first-rate journals, if you look very carefully, and I hope I'm going to convince you today, they do not produce good results on a consistent basis for a variety of problems. So for instance, they may produce bi-clusters with very few elements, with a very small correlation coefficient. We will see it in a moment. So some of those are based on bipartite graph, evolutionary algorithms, plate models, and there are also commercial implementations, Samba and Simanki, Markov chain models. So we're going to really take a departure from all of this, view the data as a matrix, and we're going to try to identify what is the optimal reordering of rows and columns in that matrix. If we were to do it only on the rows, it would be simply clustering. Since we do it in two dimensions, both rows and columns, it is bi-clustering. If we were to do it in a third dimension, whatever I'm going to present generalizes automatically. Okay, so optimal reordering. So what is the fundamental idea? If I'm going to have row 1 next to row 10 in the optimal solution, there has to be a similarity matrix between the two rows. But the fact that row 1 and row 10 are next to each other is not a continuous decision, it is a discrete decision. Therefore, we need to introduce a binary variables y, ii prime, for the rows that will take the value of 1 if row y is adjacent to row I prime, and 0 otherwise. So you see in this particular ordering here, a1 and a6 in the optimal reordering and are next to each other, therefore the binary variable is equal to 1. row 12 and row 7 are very far, the beginning and the last, and they're not next to each other, therefore the binary variable takes the value of 0. So what are the metrics that define whether two rows come together? A row is a vector with as many elements as the features, as many as the columns. So I can have a general form that is depicted here. It is the binary variable multiplied by a metric, and this metric can be the absolute difference of the column-wise elements of the rows, or it can be the squared, or it can be a normalized. So this is the root mean squared deviation you see in protein folding, for instance. So I can have a variety of objective functions, and two rows will come together when they are very similar to each other. That is, they will cluster together row-wise when actually have a minimum, maximum similarity. Having that as the criterion in the objective, then we have two models, the network flow and the traveling salesman. In the network flow, in addition to the variables yi prime, who take the value of 1 if these are adjacent, I have the source and the sink variable. And the source will take the value of 1 if it is the topmost, and the sink will take the value of 1 if it is the bottommost. So I have binary variables to indicate whether the two rows are together, and I have also an additional set whether it is the top or the last row. Then I have also continuous flows that really help us in the modeling. So if you imagine having I and I prime, the two rows, as two nodes in the graph, and here being the flow from row I to row I prime, then it is bounded through big M constraints. So if this is equal to 1, then we're going to have certain bounds. If it is equal to 0, then it will be eliminated. Similarly for the source as well as for the sink. In addition, I have a set of constraints. All the constraints are linear. So for instance, that only one can be the source, only one can be the sink. We should have unique neighbors. So I cannot have actually, I will either have the source, I will have, or have I prime, and similarly for the sink or I prime. And I can also have constraints that correspond to descending flows. So this is the model. It is an integer linear optimization model. It is exactly rearranging the rows and the columns. It is solved one for the rows, you find the optimal cluster of the rows. You solve the gain for the columns, you find the optimal clustering of the columns. So you create sub-rectangles that may be overlapping or non-overlapping that provide actually the complete information. Yes, it can be NP-hard. The second class of model is really going back into the idea of Jan Karen Lenstra back in 74, where you formulate it as a traveling salesman problem. Here are the binary variables. And CII prime is the cost associated of placing row I adjacent to row I prime. And of course, there are many interesting cuts, which I'm not going to delve into, that eliminate the tools. These are standard cuts in the TSP literature, and we use Concord. So here are two exact methods and formulations for the biclustering problem. So the question arises, can these only address toy problems of no significant interest? Or can these models address all the largest data sets that exist in biomedicine today? So we will see that. Suppose that these models can address, can have a success. How do I define the boundaries between the clusters? So we said about reordering in one dimension and subsequently in the other dimensions. So I want to find out how to partition those clusters. And we have developed actually a methodology that we call it OREO that encompasses both of these mathematical formulations, which we plan to make available freely to the entire scientific community. This stands for optimal reordering over the rows and columns. So if I want to define precisely the boundaries between two clusters or n clusters, then we compute all neighboring distances, we generate a sorted list, and then we merge them accordingly. We identify neighbors whether to fit in some of those. So we define distances I minus 1 to I to I plus 1, I plus 1 to I plus 2, and are deleted from the list, and the additional actually are being added. So you can do that for different number of clusters, and here's the minimum distance. And in a way, what you are aiming in this non-mathematically rigorous approach, this is a heuristic approach for finding the boundaries, we are aiming to find the knee that may exist in this particular graph. So how do you do that? You fit the line segment with 1/5 of the points using a linear regression. You compute the distances from all the remaining points. You generate, so you notice there are actually two different distributions here. You fit the mixture of Gaussians to determine the points that belong to each line segment. You repeat, and then you start from the rest of the points until you find this particular mean. So this is a simple heuristic strategy to determine the boundaries of all the corresponding clusters, and hence the number of the clusters. But it is not exact. So in addition to this approach that has been advocated by several actually computer scientists, we have now an exact approach for determining the optimal boundaries of the clusters that is also based on integer linear optimization. So we use a sliding window for all neighboring distances to identify the local minimum distances. And these are depicted here with the red circles. Then we ask the question, are elements from the left or on the right belong to the one cluster or the other cluster? So we introduce binary variables if element I is assigned to a cluster preceding it, or in 0 if it is assigned to a cluster following it. And the idea is to minimize the total intra-cluster cost associated with this assignment. That implies that we need to have costs associated with placing rho and I prime in the same cluster, and this is actually a linear expression, so this is the binary variable times a cost, which we know. Or we can assign rho I to cluster after I prime that defines the corresponding elements, and in this case, again, I have a linear expression with 1 minus z. Or it is possible now to consider the products of these two. So in this case, I have 1 minus z I prime times z I, and that introduces actually a nonlinearity, a quadratic term. Similarly, if it is a variable cost assigning rho y to cluster before it, I have again the same actually bilinear term. And the variable in the most general case, which is 1 minus z I prime, 1 minus z. So in other words, with this arrangement, in the objective function, what you see at the bottom, you have the sum of those terms that I have just illustrated. They are primarily, the first two are linear, and the last three are quadratic. So what we do, we introduce new variables, and we write the exact representation which corresponds to the convex envelope. And here is the exact representation. These W variables and the three V's cuts actually define precisely the convex envelope. Now, this problem can be solved to optimality within a fraction of a second. Why? Because it only rearranges. It's not the full problem. You only have a finite number of clusters and rearranges the rows and the columns. So it is possible to solve it very rigorously, actually, within a short period of time. So we have two models, network flow, the TSP, that can address the biclustering exactly, and we have one heuristic method for the boundaries and an exact method for the boundaries of the clusters. Can we use them? All right. So the first application is a set of metabolite concentration data. This is work actually that experimental work by Professor Josh Rabinovich, who is in the molecular biology department and chemistry at Princeton. There are 68 metabolites. They are recorded over time. They are for E. coli and Cerevisiae, and under conditions that are different conditions. We had a question earlier on about what about different conditions or different actually vectors. So here you have starvation of nitrogen, and you have also starvation of carbon. And this is a matrix, a small problem. We started small. We did not know whether these problems could be solvable with the techniques that we developed. So we started with really a tiny matrix, 68 by 24. So we're asking the question, given this matrix, can I rearrange optimally? Can I identify separation of the data that will correspond to the nitrogen starvation conditions or the carbon conditions? That was the simplest thing that we wanted to establish. And here it is. I would like to draw your attention. These are the four, the corresponding parts here. There is a clear separation between the nitrogen starvation condition and the carbon starvation condition. So we're very pleased to see that. We expected that to be the case, to tell you frankly. So clearly this identifies actually quite well. And if we will look very carefully at the data that are being in these domains, they have physical, biological meaning. So not only going through the GO databases, but also going through the specific, actually, analysis of the experimental data that my colleague, Josh Rabinovich, did, these are very consistent. Now, what is happening in terms of the data? You get those by clusters, how do we analyze? You have by clusters, and here is a variety of methods. So Oreo is the yellow. So you would like to have as large by cluster area as possible, and here is the absolute value of the correlation of the rows. So you would like ideally to have this upper here. Look at what the other methods do. They are having very little by cluster area, that is very few actually elements, and even when they have a correlation of 0.7. So it is important to find by clusters that do not have two or three elements. You want to find by clusters that have several components, and they have also a good actually correlation associated. If you look, yes.
So the number of by clusters?
Yes, exactly. So in this case, the red, the bimax, generates too many, which have very few elements. This is not useful information, actually. If here is the number of the rows in the bicluster, and again you see Oreo is actually further apart, and here is the highest correlation. So this is bicluster area versus the absolute area. So the method, it is exact, but it does very well in comparison to any of the other methods. Okay, I'm going to now present data on a column cancer test. So we were encouraged, at least, that we did not have something that will fail actually in the first instance. It was small metrics. So the second actually data set consisted of 2,000 by 62 metrics. This is colon cancer data. So there are 62 colon tissue samples, 22 are normal, and 40 are tumor. This is the corresponding reference actually back in 1999. And here you see actually the corresponding partitioning. We have 30 out of the 48 that correspond to ribosomal proteins, and actually that compares quite well actually with the results of a technique that was custom made for this problem exclusively. But the proof is in the pudding, truly. And here is a comparison of all the existing methods that we can get hold of. And what I want to draw your attention is this dark. The darkest it is and the densest it is, the better the method is. Because it will identify the separation of two types, tumor or non-tumor. So here is Oreo. Here is the other method. We simply outperform. Look at the other methods. And some of these are hierarchical clustering methods, which are suboptimal from the mathematical definition. But they are used. They are user-friendly. They are used extensively into the literature. And they may produce some good results. But clearly, there is room for improvement. The y-axis is the elements, in this case. How many you have? How many of those? I have two types. I have tumor samples, and I have non-tumor samples, right? So I want to have a clear separation. The best separation would be to have only two. You notice we're not perfect. We have some outliers. So does everybody else. But we have the densest concentration of those bi-clusters. Yes. Yes. And you can see here, in terms of now more analytical comparisons, you can see the data actually we are in the right regime, as well as in this case. And you notice some of the other methods, they generate by clusters with very few columns, very few components. Okay. Breast cancer data. So, okay, 2,000 metrics by something. For breast cancer data, we had about 5,000 actually genes. And again, these models are short to zero integrality gap. No ambiguity given the objective function. It's 5,000 by 98. And here you want to have, based on prognosis, the ER status and BCR1 are mutation carriers. And you partition the tumors respectively. And again, a similar plot has been created for the different methods, and again you observe that the method Oreo, that is the reordering of the rows and the columns with the exact representation, leads actually into very positive results. Here, ER positive is the white, and ER negative are the black, the tumors.
Is that a green line?
Excuse me? It's black and white in this case. What is very interesting is that the significant gene ontology, the GO terms, includes actually major histocompatibility complexes of both classes 1 and 2, and includes also the immune response. And here are actually some of the results. You see where the method is in comparison to all of the other methods. Very good, actually, by cluster area and the absolute analysis. Okay. Now, every time that you come up with a new method, you are asked to compare with established methods or methods that have been used, even though they have been heuristic, all their life, like the hierarchical clustering. So we had to do that. And we had to do that in the largest set of genes associated with yeast. And this is, in fact, what we got. It's about 6,200 genes times 131 with different experimental conditions. And this is actually work that Leonid Krugliak and Jim Broach from Molecular Biology provided. And we had to do reordering over all the columns and also calculate the enrichment. Here are the results. And they are in figure form. Here you notice on the top, this is Oreo. And what you see, hierarchical, the dotted line. And if you optimize the hierarchical, it's still significantly below. In other words, there is room for improvement for any of those existing heuristic methods on hierarchical clustering. And exact methods, first of all, can address these problems without sacrificing any degree of optimality. Now I'm going to move into another application that comes out in the area of protein folding. When you do first principles or any database-driven calculations for the structure prediction in protein folding, you don't come up with one structure. You get an ensemble of structures where you see here the lowest RMSD and here is the energy. So when you do a blind prediction, like what is now currently the Casp9 competition, how do you pick? You don't know what is the RMSD to the best known structure. So you have to do some clustering. So you have to identify which elements actually you are going to select. All right. That's what we apply. So for instance here, this is the lowest energy, but it's not the lowest RMSD. So it's not close to the structure, it's RMSD of 12. While here, it is not the lowest energy, but it's RMSD of about 4, which is meaningful for any future actual studies. So how do we pick? How do we select the structure nearest to the native in a blind study? Well, we did it, and that is, has appeared actually in the Biophysical Journal of last September. We developed a new method for that, but not just for one protein, for a set of proteins that defines, arguably, the complete monomeric protein systems in the data bank. And this is 1,400 proteins. So what I'm going to show you is comparisons, not a small data set, on what is considered to be the complete data set representation for the protein data bank for monomeric globular systems, up to 200 amino acids. Okay. Here's the comparison. Spiker is really outstanding work of Zhang and Skolnick, the best actually in the literature. And out of 1,200, we outperform in RMSD in about, out of the 1,400, we outperform in about 1,200. That is, the structures that we select through this exact biclustering approach performs better than the best method in open literature on a set of 1,400 proteins studied, out of which in 12 we do not do better, in 1,200 we do better. And that actually is going to become a web tool available also to the scientific community next month. But it's not over there, only that. There are other systems, de novo protein design, where you see mutations here, or even Senate role calls related to that. But I will not go into politics, and I will define actually some applications that come from tandem mass spectrometry, another area that we're working in my group, the area of proteomics, where here actually you identify clusters of the B3 ionos, so they are a charge of 3, B2 accordingly, as you see in the figures. But I will finish those applications with what we had to do, so as the paper to be published in the BMC Bioinformatics. We were asked to provide comparisons with methods that were not really what the methods we were studying. We were not studying image analysis. We were not studying the LINA image, which is a very popular in image analysis. We were studying problems in systems biology. But the reviewers asked us to have a comparison with the best methods in image analysis. So what is the image analysis problem called? LINA image. You have this beautiful lady. You replicate it 10 times. And then, after you replicate, you want to find, out of this stretched version, what is the optimal image. So you take this as your data and say, rearrange now rows and columns and predict for me what is the optimal image of this lady. Right? Okay, we said probably we will fail because we never consider it actually image analysis problems and we are going to compete with the best methods in image analysis. Okay. We gave it a shot. We had to add, I'm afraid. And these are the results. These are mimetic algorithms. This is agglomeration. This is hierarchical clustering. This is click. This is Oreo. You make the call. Then you reorder over the 100 adjacent columns centered around the region of the eyes. So now we focused to make it even more difficult to see, does the method really do well? Here is Oreo. Here's the mimetic. The mimetic appears to do pretty good. Look at the other methods. But if you look very carefully, you will notice that the chin is actually with the body. So the corresponding mimetic algorithm is not optimal. We don't have this problem. Then, okay, you did well on this. What about there's noise in the image analysis? Well, the reordering after two types of noise, modifying every pixel by a random value around 10% of the maximum, and then assigning a random value 10%. All right, and this is what you get. Again, it does fairly well compared to the other methods. Look, this one is upside down. And this is hierarchical clustering. All right, doing that. So, message one, all the problems that we can get our hands onto were solved optimality through integer linear programming, even though these two formulations were NP-hard. Why? Because they have done miracles, actually, in Concord in solving that actually correctly, and there have been advances in Cplex for the network flow problems. But what is important to know is, when you quantify mathematically and you have an exact method and you know what is the optimal solution, how far are the other methods? And that's what you see here. See, here you see the hierarchical clustering, and this is the optimized version of the hierarchical clustering. And you see the corresponding row-wise and column-wise. So it is row-wise first, column-wise clustering second. So you notice that the gap in the solutions that are provided by any of the versions of the hierarchical clustering can vary between 6 to 25% easily. Most cases actually is about 25 to 30%. Okay. So with that, then we ask the question, all these problems were dense data. That is, I do not have any sparse representation of the metrics. So the obvious question is, when I do drug discovery and I have other applications actually that involve sparse data, is it possible to apply the same two models that I have described to you? And here's the topic, typical problem. Why are these data sparse? Because every point there is an experiment. So you have this particular compound, you mutate X and Y to different other substituent compounds, and instead of doing the 10,000 experiments, you only do 2,000 experiments. So you end up with a sparse metrics. And then you're saying, how can I identify where the new set of experiments ought to be? So an idea is to do clustering or bi-clustering and find out where you're going to move. So this is actually what we're going to discuss. So in this regard, there are methods based on the quantitative structural analysis representation, the so-called QSAR. These assume regularity, so they in the structure, we're going to consider methods that are based on reordering and do not have any descriptors. So let me first start with the techniques, actually, and we're going to follow on this. So we have the original metrics. We apply the traveling salesman problem formulation. This is very sparse. Will it work? Will it cluster things? It turns out that it does not work. That is, the methods that were developed for dense data are not necessarily applicable to the case of sparse data. So what do you see here? It only packs these two things together, and the others remain as they were before. So they are not being clustered. So that highlights the need of new methods when you have sparse data systems and for which you want to have exact solutions. But more importantly, we introduced the following concept, which is the distance-dependent interactions for the reordering. So now you have two components here. You have the distance between two elements, and you have a similarity matrix. Here is a similarity matrix, and here is a function of the distance. So we give the largest weight to neighboring substituents, and this is the corresponding actually weight, as the distance increases. So that's a fundamental actually concept, and this is a paper which I hope will appear this summer in the Journal of Global Optimization. So for this class of problems, we developed three techniques. The first is based on heuristic approaches, genetic algorithms, and then mixed integer linear optimization, which are rigorous exact methods. So what do you do in a heuristic? Random swamping, accept if the objective action improves, and of course it's reasonable for local minimizations. They have grading pairwise strategies, sorting and of the random subset, and a sum of the, for those high-value points. In the genetic algorithms, you have the mutation crossover operations, and what is important to highlight, none of these methods can be close to the optimal solutions. In the genetic algorithms, in the instance, you may be at best 10% within the optimal solutions. Nevertheless, they're useful. First of all, if you develop an exact method, you want to have methods to compare with. And there has been no analysis, as far as I'm concerned, in the literature that provides comparisons in that front. Okay. In the deterministic optimization, we have mixed integer linear, so you may have binary variables to represent the assignment of rows in the ordering, constraints to relate the binary variables, and we also have very clever cuts that we had to develop, theoretical cuts that improve the integrality gap. More importantly, it has theoretical guarantee. So yik is a new set of variables that take the value of 1 if row I is assigned to position k in the final ordering. So in this case, we have three models. The best model is one which we define a priori the orders, and if I is close to the order k next to it, then that value, that binary variable is going to take the value of 1. Then the partitioning in the final ordering is bounded, obviously, by the cardinality of the set, and the distance between the final ordering is bounded by this set of constraints. Then we have a unique final position for every row and for every column, and we relate the position variable to the assignment through this expression, and then we have simply apply an old trick of linear programming to write the absolute values through to linear inequality constraints. Here is the sum of the all assigned distances equal to c, and here are actually some of the cuts that have been shown to be extremely useful. We introduce ideas out of quadratic assignment problems, like the triangle inequalities, and these are very useful cuts, so as to improve the integrality gap, and constraints that correspond to the fixed point are also very useful in improving the time for proving optimality. So what is the idea? I would like to have this set. You notice there are many points here. I would like to cluster that and to find actually where is the best cluster point. In other words, where is the region where I should do the next experiment. So these are the many missing data, and here simply I have put that actually in different colors. So we developed an iterative framework where you start with a sparse set of data, you reorder the sparse metrics using the previous formulation. We predict the unknown data and we iterate as we increase the sample. So the example of for consideration is shown here. I have a molecule, I have a ring, two positions x and y. I allow to vary, to have different components here. There are 62 rows, 39 columns, and this is the matrix 1. And what you see in the different color coordinated are inhibition data. These are IC50 data. So there are almost 1,229 known values out of the 2,400. So you only know 51%. So this is the previous was the initial ordering. This is the optimal ordering. So what do you see? You observe that in the upper left-hand side corner, there is a lot of information that has been actually directed your eyes to you. And probably you need to create additional experimental points in this region. What is happening for all of that? Here I have a comparison of the different methods like row swap, greedy, sorting, picking, the genetic algorithm, and the MILP. The MILP is the one that has actually theoretical guarantee, so you observe it's consistent actually row-wise and column-wise. So you do it in the rows and in the columns. So what do you observe? These are solved to optimality, obviously. In some instances, some problems are solved to optimality with the heuristics and in very little time. So there is value to those problems as well. You notice in these two instances, we have zero actually in the gravity gap, and it's about an hour or so. There are other instances where actually it is done very effectively, very quickly, and this is actually useful to have as an analysis. Now, you can consider additional, let's say if you sample 25% of the points, and here is after all the values, what is the predictive ability of this? And you notice again it focuses on the left-hand side, identifies a couple of regions, and I'm going to skip into this in terms of the value, but what I want to show you is this is the largest instance that we have considered. You see an extremely actually sparse system, and this is the initial ordering. This is the optimal library ordering applying the MILP formulation, and again you see very clear information that is being provided through these exact formulations. So what about its predictive ability? Can I start with 10%? Find the clustering, increase to 15%, find another clustering, go to 30%, another clustering, and reach convergence. Is it possible to do that? So this is what is shown here, and I'm going to show you respectively. You notice whether you start with 5%, 10%, 25%, or 50%, you converge to this almost the same value. So this is very hopeful here because we do not use any descriptors to find out what are the molecules. We do not use any chemical information. If we were to use, we would have even better results than this. Just using my clustering analysis on a sparse matrices and increasing accordingly the experimental data as we go along in the iterations, we can actually iteratively reach convergence. So you can see here pictorially, or for all of these approaches, as it reaches convergence. Okay, so as a summary, in terms of the part two of this presentation, we have seen that, first of all, the network flow and the TSP methods cannot be applied for sparse matrices. That's very important to know. We had to develop a new network flow model, different integer linear optimization problem, that would be applicable to the case of sparse data. Second important point is that we can iteratively apply the strategy, starting with a sparse set of 10%, then going to 20%, then to 30%, and that reaches the same convergence, at least observed numerically, for the complete system. But is it possible to go a step further? Is it possible to attack a very important, actually, application that for the EPA, which is I want to predict in vivo activities from in vitro data. So in this case, I have chemicals and assays. These are pesticides. Here I have animal endpoints and the corresponding chemicals. Can I go into that transition? So in this instance, and I'm only going to outline the problem, not I'm not going to present the complete results here due to time, we have 9 in vitro data sets and 1 in vivo data set for 320 chemical substances. This is the most up-to-date database of the EPA. The in vitro data sets correspond to 615 experimental assays. These come from different companies. So the government paid different companies to do experimental assays for different pesticides. They go multiplex transcriptional reporters, biomap analysis, high-content cell imaging, HTS toxicity, phase 1 and phase 2 XME cytotoxicity. So it contains a lot of data, probably the best database that I'm aware of, that has been developed over a period of 20 years. The in vivo data, which also the government paid for the analysis to do, contains 76 quantitative endpoints. And these, of course, correspond to animal studies. These are extremely expensive to be conducted. And they're conducted for rat, for mouse, and for rabbits. So the in vitro set is a dense set. I know everything about it. Okay? With all the assays and all the corresponding chemicals, we have complete information. This is the corresponding value. These are, again, IC50 experiments, which are log-transformed. So you see here the enzymes, biochemical enzymes. You see the RNA and protein, cytotoxicity, cell growth, and morphology changes. Again, these are raw data. No structure, no clustering has taken place on this. Now, the in vivo data are 21% sparse, and they measure the lowest effect level, that is, the minimum amount that if you have a dosage of this chemical into an animal, it's going to become toxic. So, these are some typical values, and again, you see the sparsity here indicated very explicitly, again, chemicals and animal points. And the missing data here are all shown in white. So the question is, can I use in vitro data to predict in vivo toxicity? That has two problems, or requires two problems to be addressed. The first question is there any structure or any pattern in the in vitro data? The analog to that is there any structure in the in vivo data? And then after I define whether there are any structures, are there any descriptors that can select and classify and identify the optimal set of descriptors that will predict what is going to happen in the in vivo? So I have a clustering and I also have a classification problem. And as Steve presented actually earlier on. So determining the minimum number of essential in vivo features to predict in vivo toxicity. Okay, so we decided to first of all take the in vitro data, do cluster by cluster analysis. Take the in vivo data, do by cluster analysis to see is there something hidden there, hidden pattern that apparently is not anywhere. Okay. So these are the original in vitro data, 320 by 615. After applying the two methods, the network flow and the traveling salesman, we identify this structure. This is optimal reordering of rows and columns. So you clearly see that there exists structure in the in vitro data. As a highlight, last year there was a conference held by EPA. None of the methods could find any pattern or any structure on this data. Okay? And I'm talking about a very sophisticated, excellent work in the QSAR methods. And they have been for many years. But they could not identify any features. And clearly, we see here, first of all, it's not only row-wise. That's why you need bi-clustering. You have bi-clustering is useful because you can identify in two dimensions, rectangles, that will be of use. And it can be overlapping some of them, or can be non-overlapping. But clearly there is structure. If we want to go a bit further at those descriptions, so here are the descriptors that have been identified and have been actually very prominent. Now I go to the in vivo data and I say, I have this mesh. Is there any chance to identify a pattern on this mesh using the exact biclustering algorithms? And look at this. After the application of the exact biclustering, we observe dominance of the low LEL values. Again, I remind you, the lowest, the worst is going to be because it's going to activate the toxicity in this part and this part of the world. And we connect that, the corresponding endpoints, to the different reproductive, liver, kidney, skeletal, as well as species-dependent properties. So you see anti-correlation behavior on the reproduction. You notice here and there. You also observe anti-correlated behavior between the developmental rabbit and rat. You observe that the correlated endpoints for reproductive are connected between the rats, the two types of rats, and the reproduction. And you also observe that this is related to liver. It forms strong clusters. We have done nothing here. We have used no information about the topology of the network or any of the information, any other analysis at all. This is just simply analysis of the data. And as Professor Pardalos reminds me, I need to summarize. And so I'm going to skip the classification methods, which are based on analysis on the maximum likelihood, and I'm going to simply leave you with a few of the relevant publications. So what we have seen today have been, first, exact methods for dense matrices, exact methods and heuristic methods for sparse matrices, for clustering and by clustering. If you want to have nth order clustering, you simply apply it one at a time. The methods are directly extended. Then we have seen that how we can have an iterative strategy for the sparse clustering, and then we have seen briefly how we can address the problem of the transition from in vitro data to in vivo action analysis for toxicity requirements. With that, I would like to thank you for your attention. I would be very pleased to answer any questions.